You are listening to the Murdoch Charitable Trust's 2017 Leadership Advance Conference, Telling the Story, Telling Your Story. The second general session was led by Andy Crouch of the John Templeton Foundation.
We're going to begin this afternoon with another film that actually was the first place winner for the Ignite Film Showcase. But rather than talk with the filmmaker after the film, I wanted to actually start by introducing you to the filmmaker. So I'm going to ask Ben Callum to join me on stage. And please welcome him as he comes. Number one film, gold medal. I think we should give you like a titanium medal now. Gold is not enough. So you did submit this film, which we're going to get to see in just a few minutes, called Red Folder. And I understand that this comes out of an experience of yours that had nothing to do with filmmaking initially. So could you describe kind of where this film came from?
Sure. So I was a high school teacher. I taught math, algebra 1, and geometry in the Bay Area. So this is largely born out of the experiences I had teaching there. To go into it, I taught for 2 years and have always wanted to work in film in some capacity. So I came very close to teaching for a third year, but thought that if I stayed, I would probably stay forever, which would have been great, but decided to work for a small film company for a year and then went back to school at NYU to their grad film program. And when it came time to make a film, I thought a lot about what I had to say, what experiences I had that I could bring to a short film, and my experience with education seemed like the right place to look.
Let's talk about the very first scene, or the very first moments, like frames and shots of this film. Kind of prepare us for what you as the filmmaker want us to be seeing as we start.
Sure, so you haven't seen the film yet, but one of my favorite quotes about film comes from Roger Ebert, who said that it is the biggest empathy-generating machine. I agree with that, and it's one of the things that I hope to bring to my work. And so, you know, I could make a film that is all about education and the problems with the current system and systemic inequity by just laying out a bunch of points, but what I hope to do with this film is to present a character that the audience can feel empathy for, and in doing that, bring about these larger issues. So in just the first shot that you're referring to, it's a while before you see his face, and a big part of that was that I wanted to present this character starting out as his teachers see him, because that's a big part of, or rather as the school sees him. Some of them aren't his teachers, but, yeah. And in doing that, sort of show how a kid can begin to internalize the ways that the school sees him.
Let me ask one more question, because you touched on it. I think it's so interesting. This is a film about a big topic, which is our, in one sense, it's about a big topic. In other sense, it's just about 10 minutes in the life of a teenager. But behind that are these big topics of the educational system, of very profound inequities and negligences almost in our culture. So often, I think, those of us who care about these things are drawn to kind of policy-level analysis of them. You've instead just told a story. How much were you thinking about the policy-level questions that kind of lurk behind your story as you made this film?
Quite a bit, in the sense that I'm thinking about the frustrations and the difficulties that I saw and that I experienced while I was teaching. From a solution perspective, I wasn't a teacher for very long. I don't know that I have the answers. Yeah. And because of that, I don't know that I really wanted to present the answers.
Yeah.
Not to talk about endings, but I think that the film hopefully starts a conversation, but doesn't necessarily give the answers. NYU also is very big on not making like didactic, point-by-point films. It's much more about having a simple concept that can represent a lot, rather than having something that sort of hits you over the head with something.
Wow. And that is what you've achieved in this film. It's called Red Folder. Let's congratulate Ben again, and we'll watch it together.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben, and your crew, and your cast. Let's think about what we just saw in light of what goes into a story. What I want you to do, actually, is turn to a neighbor or two, probably not your whole table, but just your immediate neighbors, and just for a moment, reflect on what you just saw, and especially in light of this basic structure of sender, object, receiver, subject, helpers, opponents. What did we just see, and what does this story have to say to us in light of these components of story? So just spend a couple moments reflecting with one or two neighbors about what you just experienced. I honestly think we could spend the rest of this hour just talking about this short nine and a half minute piece of art. But let's just hear a few reactions. I have a mic, which I'm going to bring around. I'd just love to hear a couple of voices. Maybe you had a response, especially in light of kind of what story's made up of, the different pieces of this story that are present or absent. Maybe your neighbor said something really insightful that you want to steal and claim as your own. But let's just hear a couple of different responses from a few tables here. What came to mind as you reflected on this story? Don't be shy. I'll come to you. Yes, great.
We had a discussion of who are the helpers and who are the opponents.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting because it felt like helpers actually became opponents.
Wow.
Because of the system or whatever.
Yes.
So even helpers and opponents were not clear.
Incredible. That fantastic. One of the very key things going on in this film is he keeps turning to people hoping they'll be his helper. And I actually think over time each person seems more inclined to help, but in the end they all end up in some way failing that opportunity to really step in the way they could. And that's the great kind of devastating sequence of this film. What else?
Andy, I've got a mic over here, too, if somebody's
okay,
over
sorry.
Here.
Yes.
So we had an interesting discussion about the opponents. I thought the young man at the end who was sitting on the stairway, in the stairwell, was the super opponent.
Huh.
And Mike thought, depending on whether or not the young man was being sent out of the classroom really to get rid of him, he could have been a helper. So we had this interesting discussion about, well, was he a helper or was he really an opponent? And we disagreed on that. Because I felt that the story, they were really sending him to get the folder meant something.
Yes.
So it's just depending on the truth of the story.
Absolutely. And what kind of system is it in which the people who are supposed to be helping you and entrusted by the system with your care don't really tell you the truth, distract you, send you on a wild goose chase, and the kid in the stairway who's not even supposed to be in the building, who looks like, I mean, you don't want your son hanging around with that kid, I think. You're supposed to think that. But he's actually one, could it be, that he's actually the one who ends up telling him the truth and in that way is helping him more than any of these authority figures in his world are? Whoa, that's complicated, right? Yes, yes.
Andy, I found myself really rooting for the young man.
Yeah.
And I think he displayed virtue in a lot of ways throughout the movie. In particular, his desire to complete the task.
Yes.
And I felt like he was respectful along the way.
Yes.
He wasn't quite sure why he was on this mission, but yet he was eager to complete it. And I juxtaposed that with a system or a school that had apparently written him off in some way.
Wow.
So there's kind of virtue, and then there's kind of the hopelessness of a system coming up against.
Fantastic. Maybe one more comment. We should spend the whole time.
I got Duncan back here, Andy.
Oh, okay. All right, two more.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I thought it was a dichotomy. I thought there was a supposed to build an empathy toward the student, which obviously it did for some people. But I saw it as a dual responsibility. It was a system and teachers that weren't responsive. But the youth had a responsibility also. He's the one that did get suspended. He is the one that had already been kicked out of an art class.
Yeah.
To me, it's a provocative, challenging story which would open us hopefully a civil discussion. Yeah. But it's a mutual responsibility here versus I thought it was relatively biased given the fact that most people had tremendous empathy for the student.
Yeah.
But I work with youth like that, and it's a mutual responsibility.
So there may be another opponent in this story, and that is Joseph, our hero. Maybe we can tell. There's something in him that has been his own opponent to some extent. All right. Jay gets the unfair last word on this little section.
We really wished he had looked in the folder.
Ah, maybe, I know.
Maybe there was a remedial plan in that folder.
If only he'd looked in the folder. And will we ever know whether the kid in the hallway told him the truth? We'll never fully know. So what is this? What is this story? Well, it is not a complete story, is it? Which is why our conversation was so animated about it. And why you're going to be thinking about it and talking about it with people for the rest of today, if not weeks. I've been thinking about it, you know, every few hours since I saw it a couple weeks ago. This story comes to mind. And to me, there's this incredibly complex question of who are the helpers and the opponents. And clearly, in a way, this story ends at the end of Act One. Right, so the end of Act One is the mission has failed. Whatever the mission was supposed to be, in this case, there's a really clear sender, object, receiver. Mrs. Johnson, I think it is, or his current teacher, who we never see, as we never see the sender, wants the red folder, sends Joseph. But of course, it ends with this frustration of the missing helpers. And in a way, a kid in a world full of opponents. And you can talk a lot about that, but there's an even deeper thing happening in this. What if he's on totally the wrong mission? Like, what if this whole quest he's been given is not even the right story? And I think this is actually not just a question for a 15-year-old in an urban high school inside a little film. But I think it's the most deep question of our lives. What is the quest that we are on? And is it even the right quest? Could it be that the mission we think we've been sent on, or that our neighbors and our culture think we're on, is not actually the right mission? So I suppose one way to talk about what it is to be a Christian is to be seized or grasped by a certain story that says all other stories are not quite the right quest, that there's a better quest. And I want to talk about that for the rest of our time this afternoon. I want to give you a way of thinking about the drama that is at the heart of being human as we understand it as followers of Jesus Christ. What I'm going to share is, it's more charts, so I hope you like charts, and if you don't, you'll just have to put up with them, because I find that sometimes diagramming things really helps me understand things better. And just as we diagram story, I now want to give you a diagram of the basic drama of human life, and the way that it generates both false stories and true stories. And I want to do this through a little 2x2 chart that some of you have seen. If you've read my book, Strong and Weak, the book is all about this chart. Although if you've read that book and are now mentally preparing to check out and check email for the next 20, 30 minutes, I want to say there's some new stuff in here you haven't seen, even if you've read the book. So just hang on. So I know some of you have heard me present on this before. Maybe many of you haven't. I only have one idea a year, so this is what I've got, like, for this year. I have many thoughts, but only about one idea a year. So this is my idea, and it is that the basic drama of being human involves a fundamental tension between two things that we have and are meant to have, and they are authority and vulnerability. That we human beings have capacity for more authority, more capacity for meaningful action, you could say, than any other creature, and at the same time, we have more vulnerability, more exposure to risk, more openness to wounds, vulnerable literally meaning woundable. Think about the woundableness of this teenage boy. And on the one hand, he's been sent on a mission. He's been given, at least it seems at the beginning, some kind of authority, something to do. He's pretty good with a basketball. He's got some capacities, right? He seems like he might have been good at art. But on the other hand, we see him in all of his vulnerability, and we identify with him, even if his story is very distant culturally or economically from ours or educationally from ours. Because all human beings have this combination of authority and vulnerability. And you can actually plot them in a kind of two-by-two way. And I'm not going to go into great depth about this. I'm just going to suggest to you and just try to hopefully persuade you in the matter of a few moments here that actually this is the way we're meant to be. That up and to the right on this graph of authority and vulnerability is actually where human flourishing happens. Human flourishing happens when human beings extend and increase in their authority, their capacity to act in the world in meaningful ways, and at the same time, increase in their vulnerability, their openness to the world. So I'm not using vulnerability, there's two ways I'm not using it. I'm not just using it in kind of the social services way where we talk about it as kind of liabilities that certain people or populations may have. And I'm not talking about it either as just emotional openness. Sometimes we use vulnerability to say that anyone who's kind of emotionally transparent is vulnerable. But I'm talking about something more fundamental. Taking a risk. To take a risk is vulnerable. And I bet if we talked about the most flourishing moments of our lives, we would find that there were moments when you both had authority to some extent and you were taking a risk. That's where the really good stuff happens in human lives. This is above all seen, I think, for those of us who end up as parents. There's nothing quite like parenting to make you realize you have incredible authority in the lives of these little children that are entrusted to you, and you are also unbelievably vulnerable at the same time. Even if your kids can't see that, you can see and feel it. It's where good things happen. But there are three other options. There's vulnerability without authority. And I suppose the broadest word for this is suffering. Experiences or moments or whole seasons, sometimes very long seasons in our lives, when we are unbelievably exposed to risk, but have no capacity to act, have no authority to change our circumstances. The interesting thing about this corner, the upper right corner, in a room like this, I can guess almost everyone in this room has at some moment in your life experienced real flourishing, where you had this kind of magical, beautiful combination of authority and vulnerability. But this lower right corner, vulnerability without authority, is the only corner we're going to talk about that I can walk into any room, anywhere in the world, and know that every single person in the room has experienced it. Not everyone has experienced flourishing. Billions of our neighbors live with suffering. But in this room is suffering as well. Every one of us has been, at some season of our life, down and to the right. The lower left corner would be neither authority nor vulnerability, and the word I want to use for that is safety. And safety is a condition where you're not asked to act and you're not asked to risk, which actually sounds, you know, reasonably appealing. And so if you want to get a taste of it, you could go on a cruise, for example. I think cruises are wonderful moments of safety. At least assuming it's a normal cruise. I mean, there are these cruises where the power gives out and you end up spelling out help with your body on the upper deck. But let's assume it's a normal Caribbean cruise. You don't have authority on this boat. You have no capacity to act on this boat. You know, your authority is limited to which items from the buffet you want to pick. But you're insulated from risk. The crew is taking care of all that. You're just a tourist. You're just a passenger. It's this wonderful retreat, right? And I actually think for a few days it's heaven. So my cruising friends tell me. It's never been appealing to me, but I hear it's really fun. It might not be so much fun as like a whole life, right? I think an eternal cruise sounds an awful lot like hell to me. But as a little retreat, it's quite wonderful. It's because authority and vulnerability together, as wonderful as they are also taxing. And wouldn't it be nice to be safe for a while? Then there's the upper left corner. Authority without vulnerability. And I think the word for this is control. Control is a situation where you have all the capacity to act that you want, but no risk. You know how it will turn out. You can be absolutely sure. I'm going to say a little more about that corner in a moment, but let me say that of these four, I think there are two we are meant to experience, and they are the lower left and the upper right. And actually, I think what we're made for is this beautiful progression from safety to flourishing. This is a healthy human developmental sequence. To begin your life in infancy with very little authority and very little vulnerability. And every parent, if they could, would create this environment for our children when they're very small. But what's meant to happen in a healthy human life, the basic story that is meant to be the case for every human being, I think, is to start in safety, but gradually, over time, increase in authority and increase in the amount of risk we're exposed to. This is what healthy growing up entails. So I have two children. My daughter is our youngest, still home with us. And when Amy was small, we did all kinds of things to protect her from authority, limit her authority, and to limit her vulnerability. We covered up all the outlets and all that kind of thing. But over time, we started letting her have more authority, but that also meant taking more risks. So she got to walk to kindergarten with her older brother. But then she got to walk to second grade by herself. Then she got to ride her bike, right? And this is more and more capacity to act, but also as a parent, you watch out the window as that little bike goes up the street, and you realize, I'm letting her take risks. Now my daughter dropped me off at the airport the other day, driving in our car, which is a lot more authority. She literally has a driver's license, which is authority to drive. And our insurance company seems to feel there is a great deal of risk involved in this, judging by what they charge us. But I absolutely want her on that trajectory. Not just for every individual human, but actually, in a way, the whole biblical story, which begins in a garden with primordial humanity placed in a quite protected environment. But what does God say to them? Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it. God grants them this incredible amount of authority, but also asks them to take the risk of leaving the garden. Even if they hadn't fallen, they would have had to leave the garden to fulfill that commission. To fill the earth with image-bearing representatives of God. From safety to flourishing is the basic story we were meant to live. That's what it was meant to be. But the one corner we've all visited is the lower right. And once you have been there, boy, does the upper left start to sound appealing. Once you've experienced genuine vulnerability with no ability to change your circumstances, for me, perhaps the most vivid, decisive moment of this in my early life was my first love, who in junior year of high school, sophomore year of high school, took me to the back of the library stacks and said, "This past weekend, I tried to kill myself," she said, "and I don't want you to have to deal with it, so I'm breaking up with you." And in tears, she fled out of the library, leaving me in the back of the stacks with this knowledge about this girl I was head over heels in love with. So vulnerable, so unable to act. And what's the natural reaction psychologically to that? It's to figure out how never to be hurt in that way again. And to enter into every subsequent attempt at a romantic relationship and other kinds of intimate relationships with various kinds of attempts at control, manipulation, kind of certain kinds of positioning so that I'd never be that exposed in the way that my little 14-year-old heart was exposed. Having experienced suffering, which is the only thing we've all experienced, we all start to seek control. The only problem is you can't actually have it. It just doesn't exist in this world. This world, I think, is actually built on risk. It's the great risk of a creator God who brings into being a world that's not a machine, not in any simple sense subject to control. And in fact, the whisper that you can have authority without vulnerability is, I think, at the heart of what the Bible calls idolatry. Because what idols promise us is exactly this. You shall be like God. You shall not surely die. Those are the two promises every idol makes to its worshipers. And what is it? You shall be like God, all the authority you want. You shall not surely die. You are not as dependent as you think you are. You're not as mortal as you think you are. Now, if you can't have it, but we can seek it, and if idols promise it, then actually what has to happen is that in order for us to experience some little taste of authority without vulnerability, I think in the cosmos, the way God's made the world, there's something like a law of the conservation of vulnerability. You know how there's law of conservation of momentum, like or energy, you can't get rid of it, you can just shift it? I think that's true of vulnerability. You can't get rid of it, but you can shift it onto other people. or onto other parts of a system that you're in. So think about the vulnerability of this school system in Red Folder that's trying to deal with a perhaps somewhat troublesome youth, right? What is essentially happening? There's a vulnerability there. How do we handle this kid? Well, he's just come back to school after being suspended. Well, what we're going to do is basically shift the vulnerability around from classroom to classroom, like this game of hot potato, in which each person is trying to avoid really confronting what it would take to care for him and figure out how to make that school a place where he could learn and how to invite him into his own learning, right? And so what happens is people who want to stay with a measure of control have to offload their vulnerability onto other people, down and to the right, put other people down to the right. We see this very powerfully in addiction. Addiction is a way to try to maintain a sense of control, often using substances that give us a kind of sensation of authority without vulnerability. But whenever that addictive substance doesn't work so well or starts to slip, what you find the addict doing is lashing out against others in the system around them and creating vulnerability for other people in order to maintain that sense of up into the left authority or control for themselves. Does that make sense? Now, I think, actually, when this gets embedded in systems, that the best name down and to the right for down and to the right becomes not just suffering generically, but specifically poverty. Because I actually think this is all about a system of injustice. And a system of injustice is one in which some people have authority without vulnerability at the expense of others having vulnerability without authority. So that what it is to be in conditions of poverty is not merely to experience the suffering that every human being has, including me and you, but to be in a system in which people try to maintain up and to the left control at the price of exporting vulnerability onto other human beings. And now you would not think that human beings would put up with this, and they won't. So this whole thing has to be sustained by violence. The only way to keep systems of injustice in place and to keep people on the receiving end of disproportionate amounts of vulnerability is through violence. You might look at this picture and say, I would really rather not be part of that story. This does not sound like a story I want to be on, the story of the quest for control driven ultimately in the biblical mind by idolatry, leading to injustice, sustained by violence, creating poverty. And so, if you have enough money, I can offer you a return to the lower left corner. And we'll call that withdrawal. And if you're affluent enough, you can not just take a cruise, but might I suggest a gated community, which will be a residential environment where all that nasty stuff of injustice and the violence of the world will be kept at bay, and you'll drive through those gates and you'll realize, inside here, I feel safe because I've withdrawn from it. And I actually was in Colorado Springs a few years ago and was in a gated community that had two sets of gates. There was like an inner gated community that you could get into, apparently to protect the people with like $10 million homes from the people with $1 million homes. That's all I can figure out. And you'll move into that place. I've shared this quadrant with some remarkable young church leaders in the nation of Haiti a year and a half ago with Dr. Brenda Salter McNeil from this part of the world. We were there together teaching on these things. And we got to this lower left corner, which we labeled safety, right? And these young Haitian leaders looked at it and said, well, nobody lives in that corner. Like, nobody gets to be safe, right? And this is true in Haiti. Even the most powerful person in Haiti, they walk out their door, there's all kinds of vulnerability. And I said, you're right, it doesn't happen here. But in the United States, it happens all the time. And it's not the safety for which we were created, the safety in which we were meant to begin our lives, held in our infancy, in our dependency, and then released into flourishing. It's withdrawal from the truth about the world. So that actually this is really the story we are all living in. And what is entirely missing from it is the flourishing for which the world was designed. Let me just really quit preaching and start meddling for a moment. I suppose that if you got especially sensitized and became a certain kind of very concerned person in this system and had certain kinds of privilege, you would say, well, we have so much and they have so little. So how about if we engage in charity in which we will, from our resources of authority without vulnerability, give things to people in poverty, but without fundamentally changing the system of violence that keeps them there. So could it be that actually many of what we consider our most charitable acts actually are reinscribing the same story of disempowerment rather than actually changing the story? What would change the story? What would change the story? Well, think about it. We've got people, let me go back if I can, we've got people in all these deficient corners. We would need some kind of intervention that would call people out of all of these. There's not going to be one thing that's going to fix it. And so the fascinating thing is that Israel's story had three kinds of leaders, and they correspond to the three deficient corners. And they were the prophet, the priest, and the king. The three offices of leadership in Israel, God's redemptive people in this world of violence, injustice, poverty, are first of all the prophet. Let me go back to that one. What does the prophet do? The prophet speaks to those benefiting from authority without vulnerability and calls them out of it to proper vulnerability. I sometimes say injustice is authority without vulnerability at the price of vulnerability without authority. So what justice is restoring vulnerability to the powerful and power to the vulnerable, right? So you have to restore a proper vulnerability to the powerful, and that's the prophet's job. But then someone needs to meet people in their vulnerability, and this is, of course, what the priest did. Because our most basic vulnerability, the greatest risk of our lives, is we don't know how to approach God who made us. We're not able on our own. We don't have the authority just to come into God's presence. And the priest came alongside you and gave you a way to come into the presence of God, to lift you up to that image-bearing authority for which you were made. And then the role of the king, the monarch, the ruler of the nation, is to live this flourishing life when you see it, you would never want to just stay down in safety. You'd want to be caught up in some worthwhile story. What does the gospel give us? Well, of course, it gives us the story of one who was all three, who confronted injustice and idolatry in powerful ways. So that's part of our story. Who was himself a great high priest who opened up our authority to again bear the image of God, and who above all lived this incredibly flourishing life that was full of authority and full of vulnerability every single moment and restored flourishing wherever he went. And then there's one more thing, which is this king actually did something really crazy. He left the corner of flourishing and entered the corner of suffering. And I think the best word for this is sacrifice. I think of sacrifice as willing suffering. To embrace a corner you never would have had to go to, but there's something that happens when you introduce sacrifice into a story, when you introduce self-giving into a story that completely destabilizes that system of idolatry, injustice, and violence. Because the whole point of that system was the quest for control. But what if someone who experienced total flourishing voluntarily gave up the capacity to act, became even to the point of being literally pinioned arms and feet, in such a way that even movement was constrained, had all markers of authority removed from him so that he was crucified. We know how the Romans crucified people, even if we don't put it in our art. It's totally vulnerable, totally prevented from acting, so it seemed, buried even in the dust of death. If such a one were to come back from that experience of total vulnerability and no authority, then the idols have completely lied all along, and they're unmasked. It's not true. You don't have to have control. You can go to the depths of suffering, and you will still be met by the God who raised Jesus from the dead. What is the story that our organizations are telling? I think there are three basic options in our world right now. The first is the story of safety. Now, I don't think any of our organizations aspire to tell this story, but it is the story our world is trying to tell. How can we get safe? Everybody's asking that, no matter where they land, even in these quadrants. We are all looking for a way to withdraw and be safe. The only problem with it, with seeking a story of safety is you've got to yoke yourself to a story of control and injustice to get it. If you want to feel that blissful withdrawal from the world, someone else is out there doing violence on your behalf. I hate to break it to you. And so that story of safety is the opposite of the gospel story, isn't it? But there's a more subtle one. We could seek to tell a story of flourishing. My daughter's applying for college right now. Every piece of mail she gets from some of your schools tells her about how she's going to increase her authority and come on, take some risks, and it's all about growth. And there's something so right about that. But there's a third kind of story, and I think it has to somehow become our organizational stories, and it's the story of sacrifice. If we're really shaped by the gospel, the only thing that's really going to unmask this false story that our world is imprisoned in is going to be a story of a willing gift. So, we're very near the end of our time, but rather than me go on and keep talking, I thought I'd sing about that and then have you sing with me.